You know, one thing that you learn maybe with age and experience is that as the CEO, your opinion carries more weight than it deserves. So it's critical that you stay quiet and listen a lot more than you talk. People are somewhat reluctant to challenge a CEO and are very happy to propagate the impression that you're the smartest person in the room, which of course you're not. So you have to build a culture that allows people to challenge each other and especially the CEO.
Welcome to another episode of Leading Prosperity, a podcast dedicated to CEO success and wealth. I'm your host, Gary Covert. We all know that being a CEO is enormously rewarding work, but it can be a challenge too. That's why I created Leading Prosperity. I wanted CEOs to benefit from the wisdom of other CEOs from a wide variety of industries, plus all the subject matter experts and professionals who serve the mid-market company space. My mission is to help CEOs of mid-market companies be better CEOs, increase the value of their companies, create more prosperity with their teams for their communities, and build generational wealth. Be sure to like and subscribe if you enjoyed this episode, and be sure to stick around until the end of the program for instructions on how you could be a future guest on the show. Now let's get after it. I am here with Erez Bekar. I'm very excited about today's conversation. Erez has been building technology businesses for the last 25 years with a dedicated focus on supporting education for the last 14 years. In 2019, Erez led the merger of Troxell Communications, CDI Technologies, and Tierney to create North America's largest education technology provider, Bloom. Today, as the Chief Executive Officer of Bloom, Erez leads a team whose sole focus is helping educators plan, buy, and effectively leverage technology in classrooms. Erez, I'm very happy that you're here with us. Before we dive in, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you came to be the CEO of this EdTech company?
Well, I sold a business many years ago to CDI and joined the company. It was the first time that I stopped being an entrepreneur and actually became a CEO. I worked for the ownership back then. It was a Pritzker portfolio company and worked for them for 3 years and then had a chance to, with my brother, complete a management buyout and we bought CDI back. And that was back in 2010. And since then, we've grown some organically and more recently with two big acquisitions of, as you mentioned, Troxell and Tierney in 2019 and 21, continued organic growth through and got to where we are today.
Yeah. Is your brother still part of the company?
No, my brother, we co-CEO'd it until 2016, at which point I retired for 2 years. And he ran the company by himself. And then in February of 2018, he decided to retire and move on to become one of Canada's leading EdTech investors. He works as a managing director for OMERS in Canada. And I came back, the board asked me to come back and start a second tenure, which started in February of 18.
Excellent. So the Bekar brothers keep delivering value for the company. That's great. Great. And he continues to be in the EdTech space.
He's in the EdTech space. He is a board member. And together, we own a significant equity stake in the company still. So he's still my partner as well. And my best friend and my favorite human being.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. I always wonder about that co-CEO kind of arrangement. So it must be tricky, even if you're not related.
I'm sure it is. And I don't recommend it in every situation. I do think that duopolies don't get enough press, I guess. I think there's many companies, maybe not two CEOs, maybe a CEO and a COO or CEO and a CFO, but that duopoly is really important. It is hugely helpful to have a person that you can trust implicitly that you work together in building a company.
Yeah, say more about what you mean by a duopoly. I think I know what you mean, but if you could clarify that.
You know, a lot of the books, a lot of the business books out there that celebrate successful CEOs tend to focus on the CEO. But in almost all cases, you will find that that particular successful CEO has a person who's been their partner throughout their career and maybe don't have a CEO title, but are just as much as a partner. And I think the best partnerships is when two people can overlap skill sets and, you know, you need somebody that picks up where you're not particularly strong and vice versa. So having a partner in this game is hugely valuable. I can't say enough. We would never be where we were if my brother and myself didn't have completely different skill sets and we're able to trust each other with everything.
That's a really interesting point. As you were explaining that, I was thinking about some other CEOs I know, and often they are just one of the partners who was nominated, okay, somebody has to have the title, but they run it, you know, still together as a, I don't think they would use the word duopoly, but after they heard your explanation, they might. And basically they run the company together, but somebody has to take a COO position and a role and title, and somebody else takes the CEO, but it doesn't tell the whole story. I think that's a really interesting insight.
Yeah. If you look at the most successful companies of the last 50 years, a significant percentage of them, there's always a second person. It doesn't get as much press, but it's equally as valuable.
Yeah. So you've done a lot of your growth through acquisition. So maybe kind of talk about your experience with that. It's not the easiest path to growth. I mean, it's easy enough to write a check, I suppose. But to deliver on the investment thesis, that's a whole nother ball of wax. So maybe for CEOs listening, what are some of the pros and cons of that growth strategy and what makes it actually work?
So the acquisitions were a new strategy for us. I mean, up until we've done a couple of very small acquisitions prior to 2019, but when we acquired Truxell was twice the size of CDI. So we went overnight from $100 million to $300 million. And you're right, there is an infinite number of risks. Most, I think the literature tells us that about 85% of acquisitions fail to deliver on the premise. We had another big acquisition with Tyranny in 2021. And both of those acquisitions had to become effective through COVID, which made any merger activity really difficult. Very, very difficult to do these things not in person. So we had somewhat strenuous and long mergers. I can tell you that picking the right acquisition is probably the most important thing. And we tend to look at the financials. We don't evaluate culture as much, and that can be absolutely detrimental. So putting together companies with cultures that are not a good fit is a recipe for disaster. And we were lucky enough that although the cultures were different, there was at the core of all three companies, there was the education focus and the focus on the customer, which really helped us bring people that came from completely different backgrounds together. I think the acceleration in revenue is magical. And if you can accelerate revenue by acquisition and keep some discipline on the cost side, you know, you build EBITDA very quickly, you make everybody happy and you create a ton of value. But you got to be very sensitive to the people, of course, because that's the part that falls apart in every acquisition. It's rarely the actual strategy that fails. It's usually failing to bring people together from different cultures, different geographies, different backgrounds. So I would strongly suggest that, first of all, I'm a fan of acquisitions. I think the economics are important, but not, I think that they're overemphasized, especially if your partner's private equity, who's very good at building models and can evaluate to the decimal point what they're looking for with returns, maybe too much, maybe to the detriment of some deals not happening when they really should. But I would say that the most important is getting your first 90 days correctly and having a massive focus on the people that are important for the different businesses coming together. One trick I learned that I would strongly suggest is when you acquire another company, lean into the acquisition. And what I mean by that is the people that are doing the acquiring tend to feel safe. It's the people that you acquired that are usually very nervous about their job and what will change for them. So in both of these acquisitions, we leaned heavily, and when there were decisions to make on brand, product lines, pricing structure, positions, titles, We always tried to make a decision that was safer to the acquired group as opposed to the acquiring group. And that seemed to work for us very, very extremely well.
That's a really great insight to think about the emotional impact on the acquirer. It always seems that there's a hierarchical relationship and people, the company that's being acquired, they get nervous, especially got PE folks floating around. I mean, their pencils stay sharp through the entire process. So, yeah.
I will also say that, and this is obviously not always the case, there's been many acquisitions that were based on the ability to reduce cost because of scale or overlap. I'm not excited about those type of acquisitions. I think acquisitions where you need to walk in and on day one start tearing things apart are emotionally difficult, not something that would excite me to do. I was excited about the two acquisitions we did because they had strategic value. They brought new services and product line, a set of really talented individuals, new geographies, new customer base. So I would strongly suggest that an emotionally positive acquisition, one where you don't need to walk in and fire people and close down facilities, but rather focus on accelerated growth, are a lot easier to put together.
Well, yeah, and it ties in with what people want. Most people want to contribute. They want to be part of a winning team. And if they see that most people can, in an industry, if they see somebody else coming in and they have good vision, they can paint the picture themselves and see, okay, well, I can see how this would work. Let's try and make it work. So if you then lean in, like you're saying, I can really see, you know, that would be a positive way to go.
Absolutely. Also think that it's important to build a good reputation as you work your way through acquisitions and mergers, because your reputation, unless you're planning to do just one and be done, if you're planning to do more acquisitions, your reputation will get ahead of you. And if your MO in acquisitions is painful and disrespectful, you're going to have a very hard time with any future acquisition. To close the acquisition and to do the merger, people find out how you've dealt with previous acquisitions. So build integrity, be super honest with people, tell them the good and the bad, make your expectations clear, and step through them carefully with a lot of care for the emotions of the people around you, so that you build a reputation that being part of an acquired company that you initiated is not going to be a painful thing, but rather a positive thing.
Well, that's huge, that whole reputational part, because like you said, I mean, if you don't handle that correctly, you can get that reputation. And most sellers, you know, the owners, you know, they want to do well by their staff and don't want to give it to a shark or some sort of bad situation, or even sign up for the 2 years for their portion and just go through a living hell of integration. So what have you learned along this journey about being a CEO and a leader? You mentioned one of the big things, or I picked up one of the big things from the beginning of our conversation, was this idea of a duopoly. What else have you learned in terms of being a effective leader and a CEO?
You know, one thing that you learn maybe with age and experience is that as the CEO, your opinion carries more weight than it deserves. So it's critical that you stay quiet and listen a lot more than you talk. People are somewhat reluctant to challenge a CEO and are very happy to propagate the impression that you're the smartest person in the room, which of course you're not. So you have to build a culture that allows people to challenge each other, and especially the CEO. And more than that, allow everybody to make mistakes in a very safe environment. So this is something that I wasn't particularly good at when I was younger. I was a bit screechier, and I think I'm a reasonably intelligent person. And as the CEO, you can throw your weight around. That is detrimental. And I'm sure we'll talk about the things that are valuable, and it's always going to come down to people. And if you want the best people, then you need to give them a chance to be a lot smarter than you. And today, you know, Bloom has an executive group of 6 people and a second line manager group of about 60 people. And I'd like to think that all of them are very comfortable challenging me on any little thing that they want to without feeling unsafe. So I think that's critically important.
What are some of the things that you do or say that let people kind of feel safe or know that you're open to that kind of feedback? Is it just as simple as saying, hey, I'm not the smartest guy in the room and please challenge me, or you have other kind of tactic?
Well, I was born in Israel, and Israelis tend to have a different approach to risk taking and failure. So we admire failure, unlike maybe North American approach to failure, where failure is failure. I believe failure is a precursor for success. So I think maybe one of the few things that I do a little different is to continuously explain to people that risk taking and failure are an absolute critical part of success. If you don't fail, if you never fail, then to me, that means that you haven't taken enough risk. You're not testing the bounds of what, where you can achieve if you're always safe and stay within the guardrails. So I work very hard to help people feel comfortable that failure is just part of business. You know, I'd like to be more successful than a failure. I think ultimately you need to continue moving forward, but failure should not be looked at as some sort of a big negative. And in fact, people that have never failed, I would argue, have never taken a risk. So everybody that I work with is very comfortable taking risk that could lead to failure. And when somebody fails, we celebrate it, try to learn from it, talk about it, maybe tease each other about it, but nobody ever gets hurt for failing if they took the risk in a disciplined manner. So I'm not suggesting to, you know, roll the dice. I'm suggesting that all risks should be taken with forethought and discipline. But once you do, failure should be perfectly acceptable.
That reminds me of one of my mentors. He would often bring up a story where he was consulting with a company, and he said they designed a series of awards around innovation. And one of them, the award was for best idea that didn't work.
So I think that's a great idea. We have something similar as who hit the wall at the fastest speed.
Oh.
Okay. Who went all out and just run head first into the wall.
Did the
and
Wile E.
favorite
Coyote.
Line of mine, did the Wile E. Coyote. And a favorite line of mine is, and this is absolutely true, is that my mistakes are usually by far the most expensive. So when I make mistakes, it is a lot more painful than a mistake that anybody else would make. So feel free.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Well, and I love that. That really ties in with culture. You know, you've been talking about how do you integrate culture. And I think that may not be in a culture that, for example, that might be an example of something that was not in the culture that existed in a company that was acquired. But what a positive thing to put in any culture is that willingness to take risks and having a thoughtful way of going about it, but encouraging people to innovate is really what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. And other aspects, and I think it's maybe other sides of the exact same coin, is feeling comfortable voicing your opinion, again, in a safe environment, feeling very comfortable to fight out your opinion. So when we get together, whether it doesn't matter what level in the company, we encourage what we call vigorous debate, you know, fight it out passionately. But when you're done, you know, we're all friends and nobody holds grudges. And that's hard to build. Human nature is not particularly forgiving. But I think we got to that over many years of making people feel comfortable that their words are not going to be played against them down the road, that they're in a safe environment to fight it out.
What are some of the trends that are going on in education? Is it a growing field? Is it a growing market? What are some of the trends that are helping and hindering growth in the ed tech space?
It's actually a challenging environment. COVID was hugely helpful in moving education ahead when it came to technology platforms. So prior to COVID, education was one of the laggard verticals and had less technology than an average used car lot. And through COVID, the digital platform absolutely exploded. And today, education in general they lead most other verticals, and there's more technology in the average classroom than in most other businesses. And that transition happened over 3 years, and it was magical for companies like us that embraced that change and leaned into it. That said, you know, now coming off of COVID, education is facing a ton of headwind. There's a reduction in the number of students. So some have moved from public education, stayed at home, refused to come back after COVID. Some have moved into private. There's a lot of voucher systems that are draining students out of the public system. And that, of course, affects budgets. budgets are a challenge. During COVID, the federal government has put through billions of dollars to help, and those funds are coming. Next year will be the last year that some of those funds are available. And there's a lot of uncertainty about the funding levels beyond the next school year. And of course, the biggest, or the two biggest problems today in education is a shortage of teachers. So COVID has made teaching very difficult. The political climate in the United States is making life very difficult for educators. There's a lot of involvement from outside sources that are challenging the way teachers do their job. So there's a shortage of teachers. And we believe technology is one way to help teachers manage a bigger workload now that there's such a shortage. It's a difficult environment. So I think there's headwinds, unfortunately, and companies in our market have gone through a couple big years, massive growth, and now have to come to terms starting next year with a shrinking market that is going to be very difficult. Product categories have changed as well. So the categories that have done the best during COVID, like devices, of course, most school districts were racing to get to one-to-one and put a device in every student. Well, that has now happened. We are more or less in a one-to-one environment. So the device business, if you focused on devices, it's a challenging road ahead. Where other verticals like networking, backend resources, Wi-Fi, cybersecurity, physical security are growing quickly. So you need to adjust your product offering and make sure you have a good mix of offerings that have a strong kegger of growth and not stuck in product categories that are shrinking. And that has happened a lot faster over the last 3 years than you would normally expect in a normal environment.
And does Bloom play in those different areas, or do you just provide hardware, or do you also provide services as well?
We provide both. So we have our two biggest categories is computing and AV. And computing is, you know, a more challenging one. AV is actually a fast growth, but we very quickly added more and more services over the last 3 years to support both of those categories, and then added new categories like STEM, esports, cybersecurity, and physical security, which are all fast growth verticals that are now driving growth for us. So I think we pivoted very quickly in 2020 and 2021. We maybe got lucky, maybe did a good research, but we were able to see where the growth areas are fairly early and pivot quickly enough that we didn't get ourselves in trouble.
If you could wave a magic wand, knowing what you know about the classroom and education in general, what would you hope, not to be self-serving, but what would you hope that a classroom would invest in or educators would invest in?
You know, technology on its own, our mission is to improve learning outcomes and access. And technology on its own does not do that. You can argue there's numerous research papers that are on both sides of whether technology helps learning outcomes. I am extremely committed to achieving this mission. So for me, it's not about selling more technology. It's about making the technology useful in the hands of educators. And there are a range of metrics that you have to measure outside of the technology itself that would decide and tell us if the technology is going to help lead to better learning outcomes. At the top of it are things like professional development, you know, teaching the teachers not just how to use the technology, but how to teach with the technology. So for me, I think the perfect customer, the perfect education customer, is a customer that's allowing us to come in with our education services team and help them do the right things to get the most out of the technology. If all they do is buy technology from us and walk away, then we're commoditized. There's a lot of people that can sell technology. If they allow us to help them get to better learning outcomes, then I think it serves them infinitely better, but also differentiates us and makes us a lot stickier with the customer. Once you demonstrate to educators that you're there to help them achieve better learning outcomes as opposed to selling them technology, then you become a partner as opposed to a vendor in that circle.
That also gets me aligned as a taxpayer, because I love to hear that I'd love to make investments that improve learning outcomes. Definitely. I would like to see that. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. And thank you for sharing some of your thoughts about your acquisition experience and your experience about your trends in ed tech area. You open to do a couple questions around a lightning round?
Sure.
Okay. First one up, and short answers are fine. Favorite charity or cause?
We get involved in charities the focus on education, no surprise there. Our executive, each one of them is on the board of some charity. So we always have five or six that we're heavily involved in. And they tend to be either social emotional learning based or food based, surprisingly. There's still a lot of kids that don't get enough food, and which makes it very difficult for them to go through a school day. Now, we also run our own charity. It's funny that you asked, but we have what we call our Hummingbird Day coming up, and where all of our employees and our vendors, we bring everybody together to build education kits that we distribute around to Title I schools. And so I love all of these charities, and I believe there's an infinite number of good places to spend your time and money and resources. I think when it's close to home, it's a lot easier for people to connect with, and there's no end of opportunities there.
Absolutely. Well, if I may ask, what are some of the things in these educational kits that you prepare for students?
So it's a backpack that comes fully loaded with everything a student that couldn't otherwise afford to buy those things can step into first day of school and be ready to take advantage of their teachers.
Awesome. Yeah. I love first day of school back in my memory and buying, the new notebooks, the new pencils, the new erasers. So that's, I'm sure that's a great feeling to have that provide for students.
I'm still excited about it. There's nothing, it jazzes me more than walking into Staples and buying pens and pencils. I'm an addict of all the supplies.
Awesome. How about your favorite book of any kind?
Wow. That's a difficult one. If you asked me in my teens, it would have been Lord of the Rings for sure. I was a Tolkien addict back when until I got into my 20s. My favorite business book is probably Michael Porter's Competitive Strategy. I think one of the smartest, and every CEO should read it. Every entrepreneur should read it. And they should read it before they even sit down to think about how to build a strategy. I read anything that Malcolm Gladwell or Michael Lewis put out. Easy reads, fascinating, give you a different view of the world. I don't read as many novels anymore, but I did just read Cloud Cuckoo Land by Anthony Doerr, which I highly recommend anything that Anthony Doerr writes.
Great. I'll check it out. Best vacation you've ever taken?
Oh, it's an easy one. A month with the family in Italy when I was retired. Over the 2 years I was retired. So we were in Tuscany in a small place, Sanremo at Pili next to Siena. Absolutely magical.
That sounds wonderful. Most important skill or characteristic of a CEO?
That's a difficult one. I'm guessing 10 CEOs will give you 10 different answers. I think the most important thing is to be able to inspire the people around you to take action. And this can be done many different ways. Some do it with intellect, some do it with high emotional IQ. I think my way of inspiring is to effectively communicate my passion for our mission. And we happen to have one that is very easy to get behind, which makes my job easy. So to improve learning and make it more accessible is almost self-serving. It doesn't take much to get people on board.
When I talk to my nonprofit folks, they say the easiest money to raise for is for children and dogs. So yeah, definitely for children, getting people lined on education, I think that's a slam dunk for sure. Do you have a favorite quote or a mantra?
Sure. I love everything. The best quotes are always Oscar Wilde. Ones like, be yourself, everyone else is already taken. He's one of the brightest writers ever. I really like excellence quotes. So things like, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity, or we are what we repeatedly do. Excellence then is not an act, but a habit. But I think those are absolutely true. And there's one by Einstein, if I get it right, try not to become a man of success, rather become a man of value. Aspirational, not sure I'm there, but I think it's absolutely true.
Yeah. Well, the best ones lead us to be our best selves. That's great. When was the last time, if you have, ever suffered from imposter syndrome?
Of course. Yeah. The last time was probably in 2021. We were working to become a public company. So in late 21, we were completing the work with the idea of listing in early 22, and then the market crashed. And I woke up realizing that we went from 100 million in revenue to 650 in less than 4 years. And I was worried that I'm out of my depth, never ran a public company before. And I sat there wondering if I'm the right person to do this. And imposter syndrome was a real thing.
Yeah. How'd you turn it around?
I didn't. We end up, market crashed and I didn't have to deal with the actually going public. And we got back to growth right after that. I think we weathered the economics really well. So I never had to deal with it.
Who inspires you?
I already told you, I love my brother. I think he's one of the world's most amazing human being. I'm always inspired by great intelligence and people that dedicate their lives to public service. And when you find somebody that combines both of those things, I think you have a magical person. And I think my brother is one. But, you know, the world is not short on people. I think you can argue whether he was a great president, but somebody like Barack Obama, in Canada, somebody like Pierre Trudeau, our current prime minister's father, who was an amazing intellectual and an amazing public servant. Here in Arizona, where I live now, people like John McCain that dedicate their lives to public servants and really respect intelligence, science, and anything that, you know, all the things that make our lives better. In my personal life, I still gravitate to intelligence, but I seem to translate public service to people that do a great job as parents. So if you're a good father or a good mother, you have my vote instantaneously.
Yeah, well, that's super self-serving to have a world populated by productive little humans, right?
So honestly, I think the only important thing for us to do, if humanity gets one thing right, and I think education is the best way to get there, but if we get one thing right, is make sure that the next generation is somewhat better than this one, and that we leave the world somewhat better than the way we found it. If we do that, then maybe 100 generations down the road, we'll find utopia.
That sounds like a man of value, for sure. To what extent do you believe mindset affects business outcomes?
It's everything. Perception is reality in business more than anywhere else. So mindsets are the most important precursor for outcomes, for sure.
And two more questions. What's one thing you do to intentionally support a positive culture in your company?
I think it's what we talked about, is the constant encouragement of disciplined risk-taking and normalizing failure. So if you can do those two things, I think you'll attract the right people. The last thing you want is to surround yourself with yes people that are refusing to take risk and just try to satisfy you, because I can guarantee you that you don't need them at that point. You know, you don't need a mirror around you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So last question, and you've given a lot of great advice, but what would be your best advice to give a CEO, perhaps just starting in that role?
That's an easy one. And that took me a long time to learn, but I think attract the best people, you know, try to get the smartest, most passionate people. They do need a measure of discipline, but most important, they need to be aligned with you around your vision, and then build a culture that allows them to fail safely. If you get the right people around you, you know, it took me 20 years to figure this out. But once you figure this out and you start surrounding yourself with the right people, the world just seems a lot easier.
So easy. Yeah. The trick, in my experience, is having the courage to put one's ego aside when you're really in the room with people that are smarter than you. That's happened to me many times.
Completely agree. And, you know, IQ is IQ, but when you have a CFO in the room, they are smarter than you about everything to do with their area. And the COO is smarter than you about everything to do in their area. And you have to respect that. You bring them in because they're infinitely better than you at what they do. So your job is to maybe hold the strings together, set a vision, inspire, and give them a safe environment to work, but they're all smarter than you.
Yeah, that's great. Erez, thank you so much for this conversation. I appreciate you taking the time to share your insights and experience with everyone. If people wanted to learn more about Bloom or reach out and connect with you, what's the best way to do that?
LinkedIn, probably. They can send me an email as well, erez@bloom.com. Took me 6 months to argue with my IT department to allow me to just have the erez@bloom.com, but it's an easy email to remember.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Thank you, Gary, for the opportunity.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. Please be sure to subscribe and or leave a review. Feedback is a gift. I'm always open for ways to improve this podcast, and I really do want to hear the topics that you would like to hear covered. If you'd like to be a guest, please visit www.garycovertconsulting.com and check out the podcast page. And remember, you can create more prosperity than you can ever know. Have the courage to use your gifts today, and let's make the world a more prosperous place for everyone.